Good evening and welcome to the School of Oriental and African Studies, or SOAS as it's better known. The school is part of the University of London. Founded nearly 90 years ago, it's considered by many to be the world's leading centre for the study of Asia, Africa and the Middle East. It can boast many distinguished alumni, including the singer and campaigner Paul Robeson, Enoch Powell, Luisa Diogo, recently appointed Prime Minister of Mozambique, and the Burmese Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi. Our audience this evening is made up of many people who currently work and study here, as well as others from business, the arts, religion, and the media. Last week, our lecturer, the writer and Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka, began his Reith lectures by analysing the nature of fear in his lifetime. His childhood was overshadowed by Hitler and the threat of Nazism. Later, he campaigned against nuclear arms as the world seemed intent on a programme that could end in global destruction. Today, he and we face what he's called the greatest fear of all, fear of the unknown. Global terrorism. What motivates those who seek to supplant our freedom with fear? This is the subject of his lecture tonight. It's a question he's been able to study firsthand. He suffered imprisonment in his native Nigeria because of his stand against tyranny there. The title of his lecture tonight is Power and Freedom. Will you please, ladies and gentlemen, welcome our Reith Lecturer 2004, Wole Soyinka.
Thank you very much. The totalitarian state is easy to define, easy to identify, and thus offers a recognizable target at which the archers of human freedom can direct their darts. Not so obliging is what I refer to as the quasi-state, that elusive entity that may cover the full gamut of ideologies and religions, contends for power, but is not defined by physical boundaries that mark the sovereign state. Equally frustrating is the fact that the quasi-state often launches its career from a position whose basic aim, a challenge to an unjust status quo, makes it difficult to separate from progressive movements of dissent, and with which it sometimes forms alliances of common purpose. At the same time, there lurks within the quasi-state a contempt for those virtues that constitute the goals of other lovers of freedom. Thus, to fully grasp the essence of power, we must look beyond the open show of force, the demonstration of overt power, whose purpose is to instruct a people just who is master. In short, we are obliged to include, indeed, regard as an equal partner in the project of power, that elusive entity that is conveniently described here as a quasi-state, the shadowy corporation of power that mimics the formal state and exercises some form of authority or control over both the willing and the unwilling. We shall return to that mimic but potent entity in a few moments. The formal state, in its dictatorial mutation, usually represents power at its crudest, the tramp of conquering jackboots through a prostrate city, etc. Equally familiar to many are the daylight or nighttime shock troops of state, storming the homes and offices of dissidents of a political order, carting away their victims with total disdain for open or hidden resentment. The saturation of society by near invisible secret agents, the co-option of friends and family members, all constitute part of the overt, mostly structured forms of subjugation. To fully apprehend the neutrality of the suzerainty of fear in recent times, indifferent to either religious or ideological base, one need only compare the testimonies of Ethiopian victims under the atheistic order of Miriam Mengistu and the theocratic bastion of Iran under the purification orgy of her religious leaders, or indeed the Taliban of Afghanistan and the atheistic order of a Stalinist Soviet Union. Stalin's Soviet Union is gone. Afghanistan of the Taliban is no more. It is this quasi-state that today instills the greatest fear, and to complicate matters even more, often boasts a liberating manifesto of seductive ideals. Only rarely does it make the mistake of showing its hand in advance, as happened in Algeria. In that nation, decades of neglect, state corruption, alienation of the ruling elite swung the disenchanted populace in the democratic elections of 1992 towards a radical movement, the electorate remaining more or less indifferent to the fact that the change threatened to place a theocratic lid on much of their civic liberties. Thus, we shall ascend to power on the democratic ladder, declared the evidently popular Islamist party, after which we shall pull up the ladder and there should be no more democracy. Let us spend a little time on the Algerian scenario. It holds many lessons for us and, of course, occupies the tragic role of being one of the unwitting dispersal agencies for our current climate of fear. Algeria is merely a convenient example, but it is also a subjective choice. My generation grew up under the indirect education of a singularly vicious anti-colonial struggle, the Algerian. That nation played a key role in the formation of the radical core of African and even black American nationalism in the 50s and 60s, served as a source of reference, solidarity, and material aid for a number of African revolutionary leaders. So it is perhaps inevitable that some of us would take more than a passing interest in her contemporary fortunes. To watch such a brave people plunged into a state of social retrogression, from whatever cause, is a harrowing cautionary tale. A reminder of the Sisyphean burden that unforeseen forces often place on the shoulders of would-be progressive movements. It is a daily reminder never to take any political situation for granted, never to underestimate the focused energy of the quasi-state whose instinctive recourse to the rule of fear as a weapon of struggle may drive even participants in the liberation struggle into exile, liquidate others, and paralyze the creative drive of a dynamic people. Algeria in 1992 was a dilemma posed to try the credentials of the hardiest democrat anywhere in the world. That dilemma can be summed up thus. If you believe in democracy, are you not thereby obliged to accept, without discrimination, the fallout that come with a democratic choice, even if this means the termination of the democratic process itself? This was the crux of the electoral choice that was freely made by the Algerian people. Dispassionately viewed, what the Islamic Party of Algeria did was simply to embody the historic will or spirit as defined by Hegel in the Quran. Ironically, this ought to be considered as a democratic advance on Hegel, or indeed Marx, since the route to this annulment of history, whose annunciation was made quite recently by Francis Fukuyama, was through popular choice and the mantle of administrators of the historic will freely bestowed on the theocratic class by the electorate itself. Choice remains the bedrock of the democratic process. And if a people have made a choice that eliminates all further necessity for the ritual rounds of choosing, well, the argument appears to have reached its terminal point. History has been fulfilled. The perennial problem with our proposition, of course, is that this denies the dynamic nature of human society and preaches that the purely fortuitous can substitute at any time for the eternal and immutable. Such a position opens the way for the triumph of a social order that totally eliminates the impulse to change or even experimentation as a factor of human development. On the political field, it entrusts power in the hands of a clique of rulers whose qualification could rightly range from membership of a military class to that of a Masonic order, a labor or clerical union. Revelation then replaces inquiry. Dictation abolishes debate. For us in Nigeria in 1992, these were no abstract issues, much as we wished Algeria would simply go away or choose another time to pose such a dilemma that provided ammunition for our own stubborn dictatorial order. Let us quickly recapitulate for those to whom both Nigeria and Algeria belong on an alien planet, or in some encounters I've had, are indeed the same nation, since they sound alike. What happened was that in both countries, in 1992 in one case, 1993 in the other, a recognized political party looked all set to win an election. At that point, however, the process was truncated by the military for no other reason than that it did not like the face of the winners. There was a critical difference, however. The victorious party in Nigeria did not promote a manifesto that would abrogate all further democratic ventures, while in the Algerian, this formed the core of its manifesto. Easy enough to simplify the issue and say, yes, take the democratic walk to its logical conclusion. But then, as I've attempted to question, just what is the logical conclusion of the democratic option? We could try and approach the question, the dilemma, obliquely, citing a very recent and instructive development within Nigeria. One which is, however, only a partial and tepid echo of the Algerian situation. After state elections, a state in the north of Nigeria, Zamfara State, soon followed by nine others in the nation, declared that its governance would henceforth be based on the Sharia, a code of strict Islamic laws. One of the later subscribers to Sharia rule was the Plateau State. In December last year, the governor, himself a Muslim, found himself obliged to take stern measures against an extremist movement that named itself after the Taliban. The group launched an insurrection, took over some police stations, one of which, incidentally, it renamed Afghanistan, inflicted a number of casualties, and sought to overthrow the elected government. It was subdued by state forces, the movement banned, and the Council of Ulamas, the religious leaders, dissolved. Would it be totally illogical to project that this could also easily have been the fate of Algeria if indeed the victorious party had succeeded in forming a government? Once righteousness replaces political rights in the exercise of power, the way is paved for a permanent contest based solely on the manifesto of holier than thou. However, this is mere speculation. What we do know as fact is that since the undemocratic choice was imposed on Algeria, an estimated 150,000 lives have been lost, several of these in the most grisly manner. And not just writers this time, cineasts, painters, journalists, intellectuals, those purveyors of impure thought, always the primary target of fundamentalist reformers. We're speaking here of entire villages and sectors of urban society that were considered guilty of flouting the purest laws of the opposition, now transformed, of course, into a quasi-state. A resistance movement that began as a legitimate reaction to the thwarting of popular will has degenerated into an orgy of competitive bestiality. Such extremism could not stay localized for long. We have only to recollect that some of the leaders of the new insurgency cut their teeth in the struggle for the liberation of Afghanistan, a struggle that triumphed with the expulsion of Soviet forces of occupation from that nation. Then recollect also that such mujahideen are pitted against a regime whose leaders are also veterans in the bruising war of liberation against French colonialism. And the consequence of this historical context for global politics, the end of the idea that a nationalist war would remain strictly within nation confines. Perhaps such a notion had long dissipated, only not much notice was paid at the time since the Vietnam War, a war that sought no more than the liberation of its land from the domination of foreigners. Regarding that war, I must acknowledge a puzzle. Vietnam, then known as Indochina, fought two wars of liberation. First from France, whom she defeated in the famous Battle of Dien Bien Phu. Then against the United States of America, which felt that she knew a thing or two that France did not. Now, the puzzle is this. I find it curious that the North Vietnamese, victims of two world powers in rapid succession, did not ever consider designating the entire world a war arena where innocents and guilty alike would be legitimately targeted. There was no Achille Lauro. Not one incident of plane hijacking took place during those wars, neither did the taking of hostages or the random detonation of bombs in places of tourist attraction or of religious worship. United Nations agencies, as well as humanitarian organizations, appear to have enjoyed the respect due to neutrals in conflict. Certainly, during the entire Vietnam Wars, it would have been hyperbolic to suggest that the world was trapped in a climate of fear. While we may dispute in the end what lessons must be drawn from this contrast, it is one that deserves close study. In the fifth lecture of this series, which I've titled I'm Right, You Are Dead, I hope to be able... I hope to be able to offer some pointers. Certainly, we cannot ignore the antecedent histories of victim peoples, their philosophies and their religions. The same observation, by the way, applies, albeit in a different vein, to the anti-apartheid struggle that was waged with no less commitment and intensity against a ruthless foe. The oppressed peoples of South Africa did not pronounce the outside world guilty of the crime of continuing to prosper while a majority race was being ground to death by an implacable machinery of racist governance. It is always easy enough to address the material factors of conflict. Nations fight over land, over water supply, oil, and other material resources. These are accessible causes of hostilities. They go to the heart of a people's sense of social security and struggle for survival. Intermeshed with these, however, but not so intricately as to be totally inseparable, is, I believe, a much neglected factor in its own right, the quotient of power, the will to dominate, to control, that strange impulse that persuades certain temperaments that they can realize their existence either individually or collectively only through the domination of others. We're speaking here of that phase when a struggle moves beyond its material causes to restore parity to an exploitative order or whatever, and becomes one that is dedicated to the seizure and exercise of raw power. It identifies the phenomenon of those dictators who, long past their creative usefulness, still cling ruthlessly to the seat of power, a contemporary instance of which can be seen in the pitiable condition of the once revolutionary, now merely embarrassing ruler of Zimbabwe, whose governance is sustained today not by popular acceptance, but by the agency of terror. Let us not therefore limit the thrill of power only to its structured manifestations and territorial embodiment, that is, the physical. We're speaking of the silent thrill of power by means other than actual governance. Power as a pursuit in its own right, an addictive, concentrate, extract, or essence. The conduct of the child, taunting and circumscribing the motions of a captive insect, or the well-known antics of the school bully. These are early forays into the laboratory of power, from where a taste may develop into major assaults on entire communities. The complementary emotion of the victim, insect, or school pupil, that is what the tormentor loves to see, that reward, is of course the expression of fear accompanied by an abject surrender of volition. To what I have termed the quasi-state belongs the major credit for our contemporary climate of fear. With the rise of the quasi-state, I believe that it is time to confront a heightened reality, heightened because not exactly new, and accept the factor of power, the instinct of power, as a motivating component of the human personality an unquantifiable element that has always governed much of social and nation relationships. History concedes to exceptional figures, past and present, Alexander, Suleiman, King Darius, Chaka, the Zulu, Ataturk, Indira Gandhi, etc., the temperament of nation builders as well as nurturers of power. What differs in our contemporary situation is that the relishing of power is no longer an attribute of the outstanding, exceptional individual, but is increasingly accessible even to the nondescript individual whose membership of a clique or activities on behalf of the chosen more than fulfills this hunger for a share in the menu of power. It is strictly out of a commitment to the moral law, thou shalt not kill, that the Christian anti-abortion crusader in the United States stalks and kills abortion doctors, patients, and innocent passers-by, sometimes operating from within a network of protective cells? Or is there also an element of the thrill of membership of a quasi-state, exercising a form of power that transcends all mainstream social accords? We shall turn more fully to the theme of the chosen in the fifth part of these lectures. For now, let me assure you that if you wish to observe the face of power at its most mundane, you do not have to go very far. You do not need to pay to see Marlon Brando in his role as godfather at the head of a mafia combine. That face is omnipresent, from the clerical assistant on whom the emergence of a critical file depends, to anonymous members of an unacknowledged terrorist organization in the United States known as the IRS, the Inland Revenue Service. Just find yourself on the receiving end of a letter of demand from that body, and what springs to your mind is the power-relishing personality of the writer. Actually, that ogre has long been displaced in my estimation by a creature against whom I readily confess that I nurse a deep, murderous loathing. To him belongs the modern crown of furtive, invisible power. I refer to the domination freak whose warped genius creates those invisible, proliferating Frankenstein from his dingy computer den and sends them in virtual space to invade and destroy the work of individuals and institutions. Those monsters are without an ounce of hatred in their veins. No wrong to avenge, no cause to promote. Without physical territorial ambition, indeed, with no motivation other than the lust for power over unknown millions, both the meek and the powerful, the affluent and the deprived, the professor and the school dunce alike. One of the most recent of these, like the Mr. Call Me God, the Maryland sniper, is not without a message for his captive world. Have the guts to call the name of Jesus is the name of the stalking horse on which his cannibal creation rides in cyberspace to wage his war on the unsuspecting. He's impelled by genuine passion for discovery, yes, but the space between that impulse and the gesture that launches a virus on the world is the space that separates the explorer from the conqueror, the adventurer from the imperialist, the liberator from the dictator. It is a space of pure, unadulterated ecstasy of power. Science fiction literature, of which I used to be an avid fan, and films of the same genre are very instructive. Take The Day of the Triffids, where plants attempt to take over human society, or films of alien body snatchers, that mostly subversively imaginative way of taking over the key elements in a community, its government, progressively taking over the nation by assuming the physical shapes of a nation's ruling cadre. We may ask the question, what is the most basic element that twangs a chord of trepidation in the human viscera? What gives that piquant edge to one's apprehension in much of science fiction and horror literature? I suggest that it is very simply the notion of coming under the control of another being, of finding oneself dominated by an alien force, an alien bundle of values, sensibilities, tastes, concerns, beliefs, and direction. In short, being robbed of one's personality and social anchor. Apart from a fear of the loss of identity to those goblins from outer space with heaven knows what nasty habits, one recognizable source of that repulsion is, very simply, the ancestral adversary of human freedom that we designate as power. So finally, to the conundrum, just what is power? Is it perhaps no more than a deadly mutation of ambition, one that may or may not translate into social activity? Any fool, any moron, any psychopath can aspire to the exercise of power. And of course, the more psychopathic, the more successful. Hitler, Pol Pot, Idi Amin, Milosevic, Sajen Do, and the latest in the line of the unconscionably driven, my own lately departed General Sonny Abacha, all have proved that power, as long as you're sufficiently ruthless, immoral, and manipulative, power is within the grasp even of the mentally deficient. So power is really neither the result of single-minded efficacy nor a product of vision. Trying to cope with, or at least come to terms with, the phenomenon of the will to dominate others, as if the endeavor to regulate one's individual existence is not sufficient burden for any mortal, I ended up with a notion that perhaps this tendency is no more than an attempt to appropriate the forces that one observes in nature herself. After all, the manifestation of raw power is an encounter that is inevitable right from infancy and through the normal course of existence, be it in a rainstorm, the force of lightning, or an earthquake. Even the casual wind that takes down a rotten branch or a roof or two is a manifestation of the hidden force of nature that suddenly exercises its authority from time to time and without any intervention from man. Nature, therefore, sometimes reveals herself as a pure expression of power. And perhaps it is no more than an anthropomorphic conceit to suggest that man, in those activities that incline him towards the exercise of dominance, is merely attempting a crude appropriation of that elemental attribute that is an expression of the very forces that surround and threaten to overwhelm him, not least of which is mortality. In short, power is the precipitate of man's neurotic will to express his being through the statement that is nature, that agency through which the various apprehensions of God, under whatever name, are filtered. You cannot, however, contain within yourself the elemental force of a thunderstorm, an earthquake, or a volcano. Those who believe they can are subject matter for the rites of exorcism. And it is for this reason that ancient societies devised a number of ritualized scenarios for the banalization of power. As a dramatist, I myself experimented with a number of rituals towards this laudable end. Rituals that will at least sublimate the delusions of the power-driven, if not cure them in entirety. I've explored rituals from my own Yoruba tradition, such as the ancestral masquerade that we call the Egungun. Dictators come in all shapes and sizes, and so it is essential to have no less than a dozen or more formats at hand, suited to both individual and group temperaments, catering to the secular, the clerical, and the quasi-state. I have chosen as my offering today a highly contemporary variation, one that takes off from the French playwright and exorcist, Jean Genet, whose play, The Balcony, is set most appropriately in a glitzy brothel. In Genet's play, the power-obsessed come periodically to the brothel to act out their fantasies and propitiate that promiscuous facilitator power. We then proceed to modernize Genet's rather primitive stage mechanics to embrace the very latest in special effects, borrowing lavishly from specialists like Steven Spielberg. Society would simply offer its ruler a unique daily experience to erupt with the earthquake, soar on flues of the thunderstorm, merge with the eye of the tornado, and convulse with the birth of new planets. Encased in a virtual reality capsule, a super jacuzzi, the maximum leader would dominate the universe every day before breakfast. For a finale, he would watch the morning product of his bodily functions morph into a celestial orb, the sun, no less, rising over the horizon, heralding a new day for his people. After such daily immersion in the utter sublimity of galactic power, any mortal must emerge with nothing but contempt for the mere pittance of awe and terror that are exacted from his miserable subjects. He would leave them, us, to wallow in our now unappealing state of unbroken freedom and the absence of fear. Since that finale owes its inspiration to the daily television projection, mandatory, of a late departed maximum leader, Mobutu Sese Seko, I believe it is only just that I dedicate this special version to no less than his current successor on the continent, the ageless maximum leader of the Republic of Zimbabwe. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Now, I'd like to open up our discussion to our audience here at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Who would like to be my first questioner? Gentleman there.
I'm Richard Dowden. I'm the director of the Royal African Society, which is based here in SOAS, and I'm a journalist. You talk of raw power and the domination freaks, whether they are Sani Abacha or your person who puts out viruses on the internet. When you meet them eyeball to eyeball, how do you confront them as an individual?
As for Sani Abacha, I assure you that I did my best to make sure we did not meet eyeball to eyeball. As for the disseminators of virus, I've always prayed that I hope someday, in a dark alley, to meet two of these domination freaks boasting about their latest success. You'll have to come and bail me out.
Another question. Gentleman here.
I'm very grateful to you that you mentioned the Algerian scenario, because I'm an Algerian lawyer who has been fighting that regime until now. My question to you is this. Have you been misled by those who have liberated us? Because you have been giving the example of those who have been killing children and whole villages. Those were the creation of that particular regime.
Yes, I have, in fact, that's why I use expression, what seems to be a competitive lust in bestiality, because I'm very well aware that some of the crimes have been laid at the door of the government itself. And others have been laid at the door of the fundamentalists. When you have to sieve between facts and fiction, I must confess that I am always inclined to believe the testimonies of those who have escaped the inferno, some kind of inferno, and most especially those who, in fact, live there, take a breather outside, and when they go back, in some cases, journalists also, you know, as you know very well, virtually write their obituary before they step out, because they never know if that is their last day on earth. A solution, for me, it may sound simplistic, the solution is a rigorous pursuit of dialogue in one form or the other, even if that dialogue has to be launched by outside bodies. Without dialogue, what you have is murdering monologues. Thank you.
My name is Jerry Jackson. I'm the station manager of SW Radio Africa, which is a Zimbabwean independent radio station which broadcasts from London into Zimbabwe because independent radio is not allowed. I've been living in London for 2 years now, and I find that people in the West do not understand what it's like to live under a regime and to live with fear. And they hear very erudite dialogue about we need to sit and we need to negotiate and there needs to be quiet diplomacy and people need to talk. Do you not think that sometimes there comes a time when a situation is so serious that there must be intervention from outside and that the United Nations or a like body should be part of doing that?
I believe very much in international action against renegade regimes anywhere. One of the situations I always give Tony Blair credit for, I know he's in bad odor at the moment, but I always try to remember this, that it was he who led international intervention in Kosovo. And he did it also on behalf of an endangered and persecuted minority. It was not a popular thing to do. Other nations were very hesitant. But eventually it was recognized that this was an international crime, a crime against humanity was going on right there under the nose of the United Nations. And so I believe the same action, kind of action, not necessarily military, but a kind of concerted action, including, of course, insistence on dialogue with the opposition on pain of, and those penalties would be spelt out. I think that is the kind of procedure I would like to see. But I would like to see African governments take the lead, a kind of peer action.
Do you find that heartening at all? Do you think that would work?
It's a lovely idea, and that's how it should be. But I see no indication that that's ever going to happen.
Well, as I said before, I can stand here and preach dialogue from here to eternity. I've acknowledged the stubbornness of dictators, the stubbornness of power, the tenacity. And so it's not easy, but eventually it has to happen. Some of the most gory wars have ended on the dialogue table. And I believe it will happen.
Thank you for that, Paul. Can you come to a gentleman down here? No. Thank you.
I'm one of the Zimbabwe Association. My name is Moses. The world now knows that Mugabe has become the African Hitler. The South Africans, whom we supported when they were in apartheid, now they are no longer supporting us. People flee for their life. And at the end of the day, the government of South Africa supports Mugabe. They arrest those people and send them back.
Yes. Yes. It's a very important point you raised. Power speaks to power. We had the same problem during the fight against Abacha. Nelson Mandela had roared in rage, saying that Sonny Abacha was sitting on a bomb and he was going to detonate it under him. Now, he spoke then like a revolutionary. He spoke like a humanist. He understood what the truth, what the reality was. However, Nelson Mandela was not the government. The government then spoke, and it was power to power. Before we knew where we were, Abacha was being understood. And it was not only South Africa. Clinton, at one stage, when he was touring Africa, when Sonny Abacha was planning to succeed himself, to make himself life president, he was asked on the tour, what would you say if Sonny Abacha decided to present himself for election tomorrow? And he said, well, it's not unknown when a dictator with a brutal history has changed costume in order to save his nation from the abyss, from chaos, and stepped in and become a good democratic president. What's to that effect? So it's not only on the African continent, it's in Europe, it's everywhere. Power very often speaks to power. And very rarely do you have the exceptional statesman whose mentality is still one of a revolutionary who speaks on behalf of people.
My name is Christopher Hope. I am a South African writer, and you've spoken very eloquently about what you call the ecstasy of power. And you've talked of your country, Nigeria, and indeed mine, and indeed others like Serbia under Slobodan Milosevic. And what I want to ask you is, don't you think that in a curious way we get the dictators we deserve? They're not beings parachuted upon us from outer space in a very curious, dark way. They seem to me to be very like ourselves. In other words, the tyrants are us. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Yes, you're quite right. Sometimes there are certain situations when you feel that, left unchecked, you might conduct yourself towards others in exactly the same way. We see the blatant exercise of power, of tyranny. We see it and we can relate it to a sense of redress, a need to redress a historic injustice, which then goes out of hand. And as I said, the liberator then becomes the tyrant. So yes, you're right, there is a component in human beings. And I'm afraid the element of fear also makes some people, certain kinds of people, embrace power. It's a kind of warding off the evil. If you pretend that it's not really a malignant form of power, maybe it won't touch you. And you know, there's a lot of collaboration which takes place as a result of that. Let us pretend it's not evil and we will not be hurt.
I'm going to take a last point from the centre there now.
Just a quick personal question to Mr. Soyinka. I'm in receipt of what I believe is an unreasonable tax demand, and I was wondering if you would be able to draft up a
unreasonable tax demand. Unreasonable.
An unreasonable tax demand. The IRS.
Oh! Those people are terrible. I know lecturers, you know, university lecturers, who live out of their cars because their houses have been possessed. You know, simply because they couldn't come up with the taxes in time. I mean, I would have thought that the shelter of a human being is part of the duties of a liberal society. Couldn't they deduct from his salary bit by bit? No, they possess his house. It's a terrorist organization.
Wale, thank you very much indeed. Next week we'll be coming to you from the IMAX Centre in Bristol, where we'll be looking at how language can generate a climate of fear. The Rhetoric That Binds and Blinds is the title of that lecture, and I'm informed that both religion and politics are in the firing line. Join us then if you can. In the meantime, my thanks to you, our audience here in the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, and of course to our Reith Lecturer 2004, Wale Soyinka.